For this Thursday, July 23rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. A significant change for next month's Republican Party convention. The president announcing that the Jacksonville, Florida portion of that event will be canceled. It comes as that state sees a big rise in the number of coronavirus cases. Meanwhile, the White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator, Dr. Deborah Birx, said in a private meeting with local and state health officials that the task force is tracking increases, significant increases, in about a dozen U.S. cities. The uptick being seen in Miami, New Orleans, Las Vegas, San Jose, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Nashville, Pittsburgh, Columbus, and Baltimore. All of this comes as Democrats and Republicans remain divided on a relief package. But we did get some new details late today from the Senate GOP leader. Also today, the Justice Department's Inspector General opening up an investigation into allegations that some federal law enforcement officers used excessive force in dealing with protests in Oregon and in Washington, D.C. It follows actions by Oregon's Attorney General, who filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security over the federal response last week, charging that officers sent to Portland violated the Constitution by unlawfully detaining and arresting demonstrators without probable cause. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where the president today announcing late this afternoon he has canceled segments of the Republican National Convention scheduled for Florida next month, citing what he called a flare-up of coronavirus. Now, a small subset of GOP delegates will still gather in Charlotte, North Carolina, to formally renominate the president, and he said he would deliver an acceptance speech in an alternate form. Earlier this summer, President Trump ordering the convention out of North Carolina after the governor there refused to guarantee him the crowd size that he wanted. More from the Brady briefing room at the White House.
This afternoon, my political team came to me and laid out our plans for the convention in Jacksonville, Florida. It's a place I love. I love that state. The drawings look absolutely beautiful. I never thought we could have something look so good so fast with everything going on. And everything was going well, a tremendous list of speakers, thousands of people wanting to be there, and I mean, in some cases, desperately be there. They wanted to attend, people making travel arrangements all over the country, they wanted to be there. The pageantry, the signs, the excitement were really, really top of the line. But I looked at my team and I said, the timing for this event is not right, it's just not right with what's happened recently, the flare-up in Florida. To have a big convention, it's not the right time. It's really something that, for me, I have to protect the American people. That's what I've always done. That's what I always will do. That's what I'm about. They said, sir, we can make this work very easily. We have great enthusiasm, incredible enthusiasm. Even the polls say, about the most enthusiasm they've seen. We can do this safely and we can do it responsibly. And I said, there's nothing more important in our country than keeping our people safe, whether that's from the China virus or the radical left mob.
That from the president earlier today, and a new Quinnipiac survey found that 62% of voters said that they thought it would be unsafe to hold the convention in Florida, scheduled for the week of August the 24th. That same poll giving Joe Biden a 13-point lead in the Sunshine State. The president narrowly won Florida back in 2016. Now to Capitol Hill, where New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez accusing a Republican colleague of perpetrating what she called a culture of sexism. TheHill.com calls it, quote, an unusual speech on the House floor to denounce Florida Congressman Ted Yoho following their tense encounter at the Capitol earlier this week. The House Democratic leader is taking a rare step, allowing the New York representative a full hour to make her case on the chamber floor. She used all of about 10 minutes of that window before ceding it to a number of other Democrats who urged Representative Yoho to offer what they called a real apology. Some background: on Monday, the two House members sparred over criminal justice policies, where he had confronted her for suggesting that poverty was a major factor driving a recent crime spike in New York City. The Republican congressman called her, quote, disgusting and out of her freaking mind for promoting such an idea. She said his remarks were, quote, rude. After the two went their separate ways, Congressman Yoho offered a final comment using the F word and the B word. Here's a portion of the floor speech by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
About 2 days ago, I was walking up the steps of the Capitol when Representative Yoho suddenly turned a corner, and he was accompanied by Representative Roger Williams, and accosted me on the steps right here in front of our nation's capital. I was minding my own business, walking up the steps, and Representative Yoho put his finger in my face. He called me disgusting. He called me crazy. He called me out of my mind. And he called me dangerous. And then he took a few more steps, and after I had recognized his comments as rude, he walked away and said, "I'm rude. You're calling me rude." I took a few steps ahead, and I walked inside and cast my vote, because my constituents send me here each and every day to fight for them and to make sure that they are able to keep a roof over their head, that they're able to feed their families, and that they're able to carry their lives with dignity. I walked back out, and there were reporters in the front of the Capitol, and in front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, "A f***ing bitch." These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman, the congresswoman that not only represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country, because all of us have had to deal with this in some form, some way, some shape, at some point in our lives.
That from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Congressman Yoho issued a statement shortly after the Democrat had delivered their condemnations, in which he downplayed the tensions surrounding the encounter and denied using the sexist slur, saying, quote, "No one was accosted, bullied, or attacked. This was a brief policy discussion, plain and simple, and we have our differences. We are both passionate members of Congress and equals. She has every right to give her account of the conversation, but she doesn't have the right to inflate, talk about my family, or give an account that did not happen for political gain. The fact remains, I am not going to apologize for something I did not say." More from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, her remarks explaining why she cannot accept the congressman's apology.
So while I was not deeply hurt or offended by little comments that are made, when I was reflecting on this, I honestly thought that I was just going to pack it up and go home. It's just another day, right? But then yesterday, Representative Yoho decided to come to the floor of the House of Representatives and make excuses for his behavior. And that I could not let go. I could not allow my nieces, I could not allow the little girls that I go home to, I could not allow victims of verbal abuse and worse to see that excuse, and to see our Congress accept it as legitimate and accept it as an apology, and to accept silence as a form of acceptance. I could not allow that to stand, which is why I am rising today to raise this point of personal privilege.
And the full speech available on our website at cspan.org. In his own floor speech yesterday, Congressman Yoho did say that he apologized for what he described as, quote, the abrupt manner in which he confronted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, was asked about these developments.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Leader, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went down to the floor this morning and said that Congressman Yoho's apology was not enough, and that having a wife, having a daughter doesn't make a decent man. And she said his comments were indicative of his disrespect for her and for women more generally. Do you agree with her on that? And do you think Congressman Yoho's apology went far enough?
I watched that Congressman Yoho went to the floor, apologized not once but twice to the congresswoman from New York.
But he refused to apologize for his passion. He said, "I refuse to apologize for my passion."
I watched the majority leader of the House accept his apology. In America, I know people make mistakes. We're a forgiving nation. I also think when someone apologizes, they should be forgiven. I don't understand that we're going to take another hour on a floor to debate whether the apology was good enough or not. He said, I was sorry. He said, I'm sorry to the congresswoman from New York. But the Democrats won't take an hour to debate the accountability of China. They refute it. They don't even give us a moment of time. But that's what we're spending an hour on, while I know in my own home community that we're getting a surge. I think that's a wrong opportunity. Yes, he made a mistake, and yes, he apologized for it, and yes, the majority leader accepted it. And yes, we have big work to do on this floor. And people should not be called names. People should be treated with respect, regardless of philosophical differences. And I stand by that. And I think it's appropriate that he apologized. I just think in a new world, in a new age, we now determine whether we accept when someone says, I'm sorry, if it's a good enough apology for them.
And that from the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California. Now to the Senate today, which passed the defense policy bill that sparked a veto threat from President Trump over his inclusion of a plan to rename bases after Confederate figures. The Senate today voting 86 to 14 on the National Defense Authorization Act, known as NDAA. That, by the way, is above the two-thirds majority it would take to override a potential presidential veto. And on Tuesday, of course, the House approved the $740 billion authorization bill that would grant a 3% pay raise for military troops. It would also require the military to remove the names of Confederate soldiers and leaders from those bases. The House measure, by the way, passed also with a veto-proof majority on Tuesday. That vote was 295 to 125. Now to the latest on coronavirus. 4 million people in the U.S. have tested positive for COVID-19. To put that into perspective, the U.S. hit the 3 million mark just 15 days ago. That, according to the tracker from Johns Hopkins University, more than 143,000 Americans have died, twice as many as Brazil, the country with the second highest number of fatalities. And the new hotspots continue to be California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, and Louisiana. Meanwhile, here in Washington, still no agreement on a stimulus plan. It comes as Senate Republicans nixing the president's payroll tax cut proposal while failing to reach a broader agreement with the White House. According to the Washington Post, quote, this set off a frantic scramble with competing paths forward as administration officials floated a piecemeal approach but encountered pushback from both parties, and the entire effort appeared to teeter chaotically on the brink of failure. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell had planned to roll out the $1 trillion GOP bill this morning. That, though, was abruptly canceled in a head-spinning series of events. The full story at WashingtonPost.com. Late this afternoon, Senator McConnell did come to the Senate floor and outlined what he described as a basic framework as Republicans continue to debate the details.
Two provisions of the CARES Act worked especially well to help households stay afloat and help as many workers as possible stay employed. So as Chairman Grassley will explain, Republicans want to send a second round of direct payments to American households. And Senator Collins and Senator Rubio have crafted a sequel to their historic and incredibly successful Paycheck Protection Program. It would give the hardest hit small businesses an opportunity to receive a second loan if they continue to pay their workers. We also intend to continue some temporary federal supplement to unemployment insurance while fixing the obvious craziness of paying people more to remain out of the workforce. Small business owners across the country have explained how this dynamic is slowing rehiring and recovery. So we're going to provide help, but make sure it is suited to reopening the economy. But temporary relief cannot be our end game. Americans do not just want to scrape by, they want to thrive again. They want to road back to the incredible job market we had just a few months ago. So Chairman Grassley will also lay out bold policies to incentivize retention, encourage rehiring of laid-off Americans, and help businesses obtain PPE, testing, and supplies to protect their employees and entice customers. Think of it this way, Mr. President. In the spring, our economy needed life support. Today, while continuing to support families, we must also get the economy into physical therapy so it can actually regain its strength. And finally, looking to the long term, the COVID-19 crisis has weakened the critical federal trust funds that Americans rely on. So as Senator Romney will explain, our proposal includes a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Senate Democrats to help a future Congress evaluate bipartisan proposals for protecting and strengthening the programs that Americans count on. Now, our third policy, our third pillar is the most important of all, healthcare. Our entire reopening and recovery depend on knocking this awful virus onto its heels. So as Chairman Alexander, Blunt, Grassley, and Shelby will explain, CARES 2 will continue to treat the root causes of this medical crisis. More resources for hospitals and healthcare workers. More help to keep sprinting toward diagnostics, treatments, and vaccines.
And yet, by all accounts, this is just a starting point with a lot of details still to be worked out in the days ahead. That from the Senate floor, Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Meanwhile, the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, he is taking the lead in these negotiations for the president. He said the Republican bill would likely extend a reduced level of federal unemployment income. He also said it's likely that there could be a second direct payment of up to $1,200 for those who qualify. That payment is expected to be similar to the one that was sent out 4 months ago. And this morning, the Treasury Secretary explained why Republicans had nixed that payroll tax cut.
The president's priority for the moment is to get money into Americans quickly. And one of the problems with the payroll tax cut is it takes time. So we are much more focused right now on the direct payments. The unemployment insurance, we're going back up to see the new language and work through that. But I think we're very clear on we're not going to pay people more to stay home than to work. So we're looking at something that looks like a 70% wage replacement, and we're working on the mechanics of that.
And that from this morning with the Treasury Secretary. He, of course, is working also with Mark Meadows, former congressman, now White House Chief of Staff, dealing with Republicans to work on the framework of this agreement. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, joined by her Senate Democratic colleague Chuck Schumer, remain critical of this emerging GOP plan. Both claim it falls short. The two held a joint news conference on Capitol Hill this morning.
We had hope with this legislation, the HEROES Act. We put forth ours 2 months and 1 week ago. They said they needed a pause. Well, they still are not prepared. They didn't use the pause to prepare. And what we have seen so far falls very short of the challenge that we face in order to defeat the virus and in order to open our schools and to open our economy. Science, 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 and science seems to be ignored. The delay, the denial have caused deaths. We can do something about it, but we must have the appropriate response to it in terms of testing, tracing, treating, just dealing with the virus. And not ignoring and saying, well, too many tests, and I don't believe in tests, and all the rest of that. So we have a real challenge. Forgetting politics, forgetting partisanship, this is patriotism for our country. We're up to 4 million people in a matter of just over 2 weeks from the 3 million mark. We have to act, and what they're proposing falls far short. But that I want to yield to a distinguished leader in the Senate who has been, well, he'll describe to you what he has been up to, but I salute him and the Senate Democrats for the work that they have done to make sure that the first four COVID bills were all bipartisan. Hopefully this bill will be too. Mr. Leader.
Thank you, Speaker Pelosi, and thank you for all the great work you have done on so many things, and now most notably the HEROES bill, which our Senate Democratic caucus is in full support of. Now, faced with the greatest economic challenge in 75 years, the greatest public health challenge in a century, Democrats have waited for months for our Senate colleagues to get our Senate Republican colleagues to get serious about helping the American people who have suffered so much during this pandemic. Now that Senate Republicans have finally woken up to the calamity in our country, they have been so divided, so disorganized, so unprepared that they have struggled to even draft a partisan proposal within their own conference. They can't come together. Even after all this time, it appears the Republican legislative response to COVID is ununified, unserious, unsatisfactory.
Those comments earlier today from Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. So where did things stand this evening? Siobhan Hughes is following the story for The Wall Street Journal, and it seems as if there's still some deep divisions among Senate Republicans on how to proceed.
There are deep divisions among Senate Republicans on how to proceed. Thursday, late afternoon, we saw Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell come to the floor and effectively say there was still no deal. Now, he cast it optimistically. He said we have a framework and details will be revealed on Monday, but we were expecting those details to emerge today. There are divisions among Republicans. One of the biggest of those has to do with unemployment insurance, how much additional federal assistance to provide people, although, of course, that's not the only division.
And Democrats are still pushing for aid to states and cities. Will that happen?
Democrats are still pushing for aid to states and cities, and they will have a strong negotiating hand once Republicans come out with their deal, because a lot of the public is behind the Democrats. Republicans, of course, are defending more Senate seats than the Democrats are. And there are two Republicans from Louisiana, both of whom very, very much support more aid to states and localities, given that cities like New Orleans are hurting. And so there is certainly some leverage. Now, the counterweight, of course, are the conservatives in Mr. McConnell's own Republican conference. Those conservatives are loath to provide any more money. Many of them are already balking at the $1 trillion price tag that Republicans have put on whatever they plan to unveil. And they're particularly concerned because they know $1 trillion in a negotiation with Nancy Pelosi ends up becoming a floor, and the number is likely to rise above that.
And of course, all of this comes with a looming deadline, because for many Americans, the additional unemployment benefits will end next week.
That's right. The additional unemployment benefits end July 31st. And as a practical matter, practically, the deadline is July 25th, because states need at least a week's notice before processing those next claims. So we're already in a situation where there could be some snafus for people receiving their unemployment, their federal unemployment checks in early August.
As the details continue to unfold in the coming days, we'll follow your work at WSJ.com. Siobhan Hughes covers Congress for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here.
On Wall Street, a disappointing day for the markets. The Dow losing more than 350 points. The Nasdaq was down 244, and the S&P was off by 40. With the debate between Democrats and Republicans on expanding jobless benefits, the former Labor Secretary from the Clinton administration weighing in on the issue, Robert Reich testifying before today's House Financial Services Committee. He's now a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley, and commented on whether additional benefits, in fact, discourages Americans from finding work.
More than 1.4 million workers filed new claims for state unemployment insurance benefits last week, the first increase in almost 3 months. In addition, 975,000 new claims from freelancers and part-timers, others who don't qualify for regular state unemployment insurance benefits. What you draw from this is that their pain is very, very broad, and that the economic crisis is not going away. If anything, the evidence shows that the economy is, to a large degree, worsening. Expanded unemployment benefits are set to expire in 8 days, leaving at least 21 million Americans with 60% income reduction, because they would have to fall back on state unemployment insurance without the extra federal benefit, and millions more will be out in the cold entirely. I want to also emphasize something that Secretary Donovan emphasized, and that is that 32% of Americans have missed their July housing payments. This is both rent payments, but also you've got a lot of Americans, more than a third by the data I have, that have also missed their mortgage payments. So the degree of the housing crisis is extraordinary. 5.4 million Americans have lost their employee-provided health benefits between February and May. We don't have good data beyond May, but we know that that is also part of the crisis. The $600 per week payments contained in the HEROES Act should be continued at least through the end of the year.
That from Robert Reich. He served in the Clinton administration as Labor Secretary, in his testimony via Zoom before the House Financial Services Committee. By the way, the president likely to sign an executive order tomorrow aimed at lowering drug prices. It would elevate a key issue in this election year. A number of Republican lawmakers have been invited to an event at the White House focusing on drug pricing, scheduled for 3 p.m. Friday. TheHill.com is reporting that one order likely to include a version of a proposal that would reduce some U.S. drug prices by tying them to lower prices paid in other countries. You're listening to Washington Today. And we welcome you back to Washington Today for this Thursday, July 23rd on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines in campaign 2020. Democratic candidate Joe Biden opening up a 13-point lead over President Trump in the key battleground state of Florida. The former vice president leading the president 51% to 38%. This from the latest Quinnipiac survey. It shows a sharp increase since Florida voters were last surveyed back in April, when Joe Biden had a very narrow lead of 46% to 42% for President Trump. The president narrowly winning Florida and its 29 electoral votes back in 2016, edging Hillary Clinton by just over 1 percentage point. And it is play ball for the Washington Nationals and the New York Yankees at Nats Park here in Washington, D.C. But one player, Juan Soto, will miss the start of the season, the team confirming earlier today he tested positive for COVID-19. At Tuesday's White House news conference, one question to the president regarding Ghislaine Maxwell sparking a lot of reaction. She, of course, is the former longtime confidant and one-time girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein. She is now charged with sex trafficking minors and remains in a New York City jail. Her bail was denied. Here's the president on Tuesday.
Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison, and so a lot of people want to know if she's going to turn in powerful people. And I know you've talked in the past about Prince Andrew, and you've criticized Bill Clinton's behavior. I'm wondering, do you feel that she's going to turn in powerful men? How do you see that working out?
I don't know. I haven't really been following it too much. I just wish her well, frankly. I've met her numerous times over the years, especially since I lived in Palm Beach, and I guess they lived in Palm Beach. But I wish her well. Whatever it is, I don't know the situation with Prince Andrew. Just don't know. Not aware of it.
And that from the president earlier this week. Well, on Fox News, Brett Baer asking the White House press secretary about his remarks wishing Ms. Maxwell well.
The other day he was asked about Ghislaine Maxwell, who's being federally prosecuted for allegedly recruiting, grooming, sexually abusing underage girls. He said, I just wish her well, frankly. I wish her well. That raised some eyebrows, Kayla.
Well, what the president was noting is that the last person who was charged in this case ended up dead in a jail cell. And the president wants justice to be served for the victims in this case. And he prefers this to play out in a courtroom.
And that's, have you talked to him about that?
I have spoken to him about that.
Because a lot of people were saying it just seemed a strange answer, but
and let me know one more thing, Brett. You know, this president is the president that that banned Jeffrey Epstein from coming to Mar-a-Lago. This president was always on top of this, ahead of this, noting this banning this man from his property long before this case was even being played out in a court of law.
That from the White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, on Fox News earlier today. On Twitter, the president taking aim at a member of the House Republican leadership, Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney. She has opposed the president's plan for troop withdrawals, adding his voice to an open feud between some of his closest congressional allies. It was earlier this week when a number of conservative Republicans calling on the congresswoman to be more supportive of the president. On Twitter, President Trump wrote the following, quote, Liz Cheney is only upset because I have been actively getting our great and beautiful country out of the ridiculous and costly endless wars. I'm also making our so-called allies pay tens of billions of dollars in delinquent military costs. And with reaction, this from the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy.
Yes, Julie.
Today, President Trump was going after your colleague Liz Cheney and retweeted Rand Paul and Matt Gaetz calling for her to step down or be removed from leadership. And I was wondering what your response is to that.
Look, I know people in our party, we're allowed to have differences of opinion, especially when it comes to foreign policy. I think Liz Cheney and the president agree 98% of the time. And there's nothing wrong with having a discussion about different ways of going forward. But I think the best part is that we're united and we don't air these in public.
That from Congressman Kevin McCarthy, of course, is the House Republican leader. Private funeral services were held today in Atlanta for the late civil rights leader, C.T. Vivian, who died earlier this month. He was 95 years old. Back in 1947, he led the first ever sit-in to desegregate Barton's Cafeteria in Peoria, Illinois. He was part of the Freedom Rides to Mississippi back in 1961, served as a close advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King, and advised Presidents Johnson, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and Obama on the issues of civil rights. Today, former Vice President Joe Biden reflecting on his life and career.
A soldier who refused to raise his fist. A preacher's voice helped electrify a movement. A leader who inspired generations to join him in the ceaseless march of progress. CT didn't waste a single one of the days God granted him. But we all know that CT's spirit is going to continue to inspire us to fulfill his mission, a mission that remains unfinished. Our fight for racial justice to state the obvious is incomplete. And CT's memory now commissions all of us into service to finish the work of perfecting our union, to make sure every person can freely exercise their sacred right to vote, to bring us that much closer to our ideals of equity and justice for all.
Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential candidate on C.T. Vivian, funeral services held earlier today in Atlanta. Well, the battle over statues and symbols continues here in Washington. The latest came from Texas Congressman Louie Gohmert, who introduced a resolution calling for Congress to ban any political organization or party that has ever held a public position supportive of slavery or the Confederacy. The Republican lawmaker specifically pointing to the Democratic Party's position on slavery. More on the House floor.
Whereas on July 22, 2020, House Resolution 7573 was brought to the House floor for a vote with the purpose of eliminating four specific statues or busts from the United States Capitol, along with all others that include individuals who, quote, served as an officer or voluntarily with the Confederate States of America or the military forces or government of a state while the state was in rebellion against the United States, unquote, yet failed to address the most ever-present historical stigma of the United States Capitol. That is the source that so fervently supported, condoned, and fought for slavery that was left untouched, but without whom the evil of slavery could never have continued as it did, to such extreme that it is necessary to address here in order for the U.S. House of Representatives to avoid degradation of historical fact and blatant hypocrisy for generations to come.
That from Congressman Gohmert. His resolution, by the way, co-sponsored by Representatives Andy Biggs, Jody Heiss, Randy Weber, and Andy Harris. House Democrats today had some tough questions for John Barsa. He is the acting administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development. The House Foreign Affairs Committee scheduled the hearing to discuss the Trump administration's budget request for the next fiscal year. But a number of Democrats seizing on the hearing to go after John Barsa on the appointments of a number of pro-Trump conservatives to key USAID positions. One of those individuals, Merritt Corrigan, who is USAID's deputy White House liaison. On Twitter last year, she wrote the following, quote, "Our homo empire could not tolerate even one commercial enterprise not in full submission of the tyrannical LGBTQ agenda." She also decried what she said was liberal democracy. Here's Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly with the acting USAID administrator.
Mr. Barsa, I didn't hear your answer. other than a reassertion that aid is committed to equity and fairness. But Ms. Titus ran, you know, gave you a catalog of individuals in your agency who have spewed hateful statements about LGBT members, about those who adhere to the Islamic faith. You have one member on your staff from the Family Research Council that's been dubbed a hate group. Are those people's views representative of yours or of the current philosophy governing AID?
Congressman, I have to reiterate what I said before. While someone is working for me at USAID, regardless of hiring category, civil servant, foreign service officer, or political appointee, everyone is held to the same high legal, moral, and ethical standards that have always existed.
Mr. Barca, that doesn't answer the question. That begs the question. These are people with a history. Are you comfortable with that history in hiring them, in having them on your payroll, in representing the United States of America?
I have systems in place to ensure that people who are representing the United States as USAID employees do live up to the high standards.
So if somebody came to you with an explicitly hate-filled, racist rant and a history of it, posting it, tweeting it, going on bots and spreading it, as long as they said, well, that was then, this is now, I will adhere to the standards of AID, from your point of view, that's a qualified employee. It's, or at least it's not a disqualified potential employee.
Throughout, the appointment of political appointees occurs as a conversation between the White House and whatever agency in place. So regarding the vetting and the placement of appointees, I would have to refer you to the White House. What I can assure you, once they are in, as an employee of mine at USAID, we have certain standards that we uphold people to.
Well, I've been working with aid for over 40 years, and I have never seen it peopled with individuals who have those kinds of records. And I think it's a shameful moment for aid. And it's shameful, if you're right, that those come from, because they're political appointees from the White House. It's another blot on this White House.
From today's House Foreign Affairs Committee, John Barca is the acting administrator for USAID, and questions from Congressman Jerry Connolly, Democrat from Northern Virginia. Here in Washington at Nationals Park, it is play ball. Dr. Anthony Fauci, a huge Nats fan, throwing out the first pitch in a game between the reigning World Series champions and the New York Yankees. It is, of course, an abbreviated season, only 60 games, a season starting 4 months later than normal as a result of coronavirus. In the past, presidents have often been at ballparks on opening day, the All-Star Game, or the World Series. And back in September of 1988, there was this moment at Wrigley Field with the 40th President of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
The Cubs are honored to have a special guest here today. Please welcome the President of the United States throwing out the ceremonial first pitch.
A great hand for the President of the United States. He's had two great presidencies, John Madigan greeting him, Mary Ellen Cobb, the ball girl. Boy, oh boy, does he ever look good? How does he do it?
What a moment this is in the history of Wrigley Field.
How about a moment for Mary Ellen Cobb as she walks the president out to the pitching mound? Now let's see the form he displays. And Damian Berryhill, who's from Southern California, proud giving him a great welcome. Now let's watch his pitch. High and inside.
And that from September of 1988, Wrigley Field, and the voice of Harry Carey. Joining us on the phone is Colleen Shogan. She is Senior Vice President for the White House Historical Association. Brings back memories, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does.
As you listen to that, walk us through presidents and their role in baseball, whether it's the opening game, the All-Star game, or the World Series.
Sure. So some of the first presidents to love baseball were way back into the 1860s. Abraham Lincoln liked to watch games on the South Lawn of the White House. It was known then as the White Lot because there was a white fence that surrounded the lot. And those were amateur games at the time, but there's some firsthand accounts of Lincoln actually joining in on some of the baseball games with his long strides, being able to eat up the distance between the bases. And his successor, actually, a lot of people are surprised by this, but his successor, Andrew Johnson, was also a big baseball fan and would take in semi-professional amateur games once again on the South Lawn of the White House where the Ellipse now stands, and even gave federal workers time off to watch some of the baseball games.
Why has baseball really become America's game and also the president's game?
Well, there's a long tradition. Then after Lincoln and Johnson, you really fast forward to William Howard Taft, who is the first president to throw a pitch out on opening day. And there's a very interesting story behind that that I'd be happy to share. But I think a lot of it has to do with the accessibility of baseball and softball. I think more kids play baseball and softball as they're growing up in youth than any other sport. I think that's because kids of varying talent, athletic talent, can actually play baseball and softball or t-ball and really enjoy it. And then as a game itself, even at the professional level, it's accessible for families to go to a baseball game, a professional baseball game. There's a wide variety of pricing for the tickets. And even if you aren't able to go to a major league baseball stadium, you can go to a minor league baseball stadium, AA, AAA, and really enjoy the game very much in a affordable fashion.
And the story regarding William Howard Taft?
Yes, this is a terrific story. So the date of the first pitch was April 14th, 1910. And William Howard Taft had not planned on going to the season opener for the Washington Senators that day. But he had a very difficult morning. He was invited to speak to the suffragists who were advocating for the 19th Amendment, who were having their national conference in Washington, D.C. And because he had accepted the invitation, the suffragists thought that he was going to support them. And he was a Republican, and Republicans were more supportive of women's suffrage. So they thought that he was going to announce his support for women voting. But he did not. He actually came out in opposition to women voting and said a few things that were not very kind to the women. And he was actually hissed and booed by the women during the conference. And there's a lot of newspaper accounts of this the next day. So after this, Taft was very upset by this. He had not been publicly ridiculed like that. And it was a beautiful day in Washington, D.C., a beautiful springtime day. So he decided to throw caution to the wind and spontaneously go to National Park at the time and to see the home opener for the Washington Senators. When he got to the park, it was really the Senators' manager, a man by the name of Jimmy McAleer, who invited him to throw out the first pitch from the grandstand. And when he did, he started the tradition of presidents throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game, and especially on opening day.
And of course, more recently, Richard Nixon had a passion for sports, especially baseball. And George W. Bush was the part owner of the Texas Rangers.
Absolutely. Richard Nixon was a great fan of the game. He was a great student of the game. I think he liked the statistics that went along with it. It suited his sort of encyclopedic knowledge. He had a great quote. He said one of his quotes was, "I don't know a lot about politics, but I know a lot about baseball." And very famously, in 1972, he was asked by a reporter covering his reelection campaign if he could create an all-star team for baseball of all time. And what Nixon ended up doing was going to Camp David with his son-in-law at the time, David Eisenhower, who knew a lot about baseball, and they came up with actually four teams. So he had teams from the pre-war era and the post-war era, and he had, of course, American League teams and National League teams. So he came up with four separate rosters and released that to the press, and a lot of newspapers reprinted it. The one periodical that did not was Sports Illustrated, who said this was a publicity stunt for his reelection and refused to reprint it. But it was generally accepted as a very knowledgeable roster. And then, of course, George W. Bush was the only president to own a Major League Baseball team and then, of course, become president of the United States, a great baseball fan, owner of the Texas Rangers. He started T-ball on the South Lawn. He hosted over 20 games for boys and girls to come on the South Lawn of the White House. But probably President Bush's biggest day in baseball was actually when he was president, and that was on October 30th, 2001, when he threw out the first pitch of Game 3 of the World Series versus the New York Yankees and the Arizona Diamondbacks. And this was only 30 days, a little bit over a month after September 11th. It was viewed as a very risky prospect for President Bush to actually take the mound in Yankee Stadium. But he put on a Fire Department of New York FDNY jacket on with a bulletproof vest on underneath it. And he walked out onto the mound and threw a perfect strike. And the crowd completely erupted in applause, chants of USA. And I watched the clip yesterday to refresh my memory. And I noticed that President Bush actually, there were some tears in his eyes as he came off the mound. So it was, he reacted upon that as one of the greatest days of his presidency.
And on this opening day of what is an abbreviated season for MLB, some history from Colleen Shogan. She is Senior Vice President of the White House Historical Association. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And a reminder, this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. You can get it wherever you download your favorite podcast. Also on the web, along with all of our programming, part of the video library at cspan.org. Thanks for joining us for this Thursday edition of Washington Today. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Enjoy the rest of your evening.